That's out.
Oh, he's dropped it. I don't believe it. That's unbelievable. He was throwing it up. He thought he had it. It was a little lollipop. And the man who did so well with the bat has taken his eye off the ball, and the ball has just dribbled out of his fingers. He was about to throw it up.
Hey, great cricket.
The Great Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the Great Cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer Podcast. On today's show, we're talking Australia versus India, England and Bangladesh, New Zealand and Afghanistan. Irish cricket legend Niall O'Brien is on the show, and Grade Cricketer best friend Adam Collins is also on the show. Before we get into hashtag RTGC, my name is Ian Higgins. I'm joined by Sam Perry in Melbourne. Pez, how is your long weekend going?
Well, morning, Higgos. As a freelancer, a long weekend means nothing. My wife is also a shift worker as well, so our connection to societal holidays and whatnot is very scarce at the moment. Thank you for asking anyway. I did, regardless, stay up to watch Australia versus India, or a large portion of it. Mm-hmm. And can I just say, Australia started behind in the match and stayed there. It was a performance I think many of its critics had expected. There was questionable support bowling. The 30 overs that the support bowlers, I call them support bowlers, bowled, yielded 3 wickets for 216 runs. There was 5 wickets throughout the whole 50 overs. I think one thing we can say from that first innings is, and this is a bit of a blueprint for other teams, it's almost like no Stark, no Australia. It was a slowish wicket with no swing. So it almost negates what Mitchell Stark can do. And then after that, they just sort of labour that Aussie side. India made 356, Shikhar Dhawan 117. They seem to do it fairly easy. Yeah. Walking like a dude, Kohli, 82. Song still in my head from 5 weeks ago. Dhoni biffed a couple. The rare, I suppose, error in the Australian field was Alex Carey dropping Hardik Pandya on his first ball, who wanted to make a quick 540-odd as well. Mm. India with 356. And then Australia, they batted really slowly to commence. So if you look at it individually, here goes some decent scores. Warner made 50-odd. Finch was a runner ball, 36, before Warner absolutely burned him. Mm. Smith, 69 off 70. And then later on, Alex Carey hit the tournament's quickest 50. He's batting quite well. But the cumulative effect was just an extremely slow start, being behind the eight ball and then leaving Glenn Maxwell and Alex Carey too much to do.
Mm. I think, nice summation of the game there, Pez, if I may say so myself. I think there's an instinct to think that, you know, now that we've lost a game for the first time in 10 matches or whatever, that the world must now fall in and Australia will lose every game. I think fundamentally India are a better team than Australia. There's probably two teams better equipped on paper to win matches of cricket in this World Cup, England and India, and India's one of those countries, obviously. So, but I do think that, like, you look at the squad, and when you play someone that's better than you, it does reveal some weaknesses. And I thought with the new ball, Cummins and Stark did quite a good job. Coulton Isle comes on and goes for 16 in his first over, or 14 in his first over, just to release the pressure. And it's not so much that he bowled poorly. I think it just shows that teams are going to go, well, if we just get through Cummins and Stark with a new ball, we can go at, you know, 8 and over for those innings with facing Zampa, Stoinis, Maxwell, and Coulton Isle. So, you know, I still haven't quite figured out what a Coulton Isle is because he batted amazingly against the West Indies. What a great innings. But I almost feel like, you know, in a great cricket sense, you can always have a day out in the sun, and that's your one for the season. And that'll keep you playing for 5 more seasons, et cetera, et cetera. But I just wonder, like, would Australia be stronger if Josh Hazlewood was there? Like, I think, like, you can't rely on your number eight batsman to get 90 runs to D you out and win you a game from number eight. Like, that's not how Australia want to win games of cricket. I just wonder if there was just another really strong bowler there, probably a seamer, to fill that role. I don't know. I just feel like this. I've also got big question marks about Stoinis, who just hasn't scored a run in ages, and his bowling just looks really – it just looks comfortable to face.
Yeah. I think they're fair questions as well. How do you plug the holes, really? I mean, what you can, and I like that you are riding Kutenile. Kutenile. He probably is that too.
Yeah.
In the whole Sydney rhyming slang parlance.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Good save. I like that you're riding him a little bit as well. Let's not forget. I mean, he has won the match against the West Indies. Without him, Australia could be staring at two defeats already this World Cup. I think what you say about them being an inferior side to India is spot on as well. So the question is, what do you do with the current side? I think the people in the gun are probably the support bowlers. I think you have to. I think they're going to need to retain Zampa. He still is a wicket-taking threat in those middle overs relative to the rest of the side. But the guys that they do have in reserve probably do have a bit more potency when it comes to taking wickets. Kane Richardson, with his array of slower balls into the wicket, has got a great record at T20 level of being able to take wickets and just disrupt the flow of batsmen. He can be expensive. Berendorf, the same thing. And then Lyon, at the other side of the spectrum, is a great containing bowler as well. So I think you're right, though, Higgins. I think it's hard to say because they come up against Pakistan next, Australia, who are a completely different outfit.
Yeah.
And maybe the current squad is well equipped to beat them. But you're right. I mean, how they're going to be able to beat England and India if they get the opportunity to play either one of them again in the tournament is really the question. Both sides in this latest round kind of executed their game plan perfectly. I felt like India are a really good side and did it quite easily last night. Interestingly, you know, when Australia last chased 356, it was 358 against India in that last tournament over there. They're in a similar position, and then Ashton Turner came in and hit 80 off 40 odd.
Yeah.
So they didn't pick Turner this time, and they didn't have the firepower to get there.
Yeah. It's interesting. Australia's next three games, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh. So Australia will go in as favourites and probably relatively strong favourites in all three of those games. So all of these sins for this match might be forgotten before they then play against England, which will obviously be another massive test for Australia. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here. They might rotate the squad. I noticed that, like, in the press conference after the game, just to just completely ride Kutenile again, that he was saying that he was expecting to get dropped. You know, he's in the team to take wickets and he hadn't taken a wicket yet. I mean, he picked up the wicket of Sharma, and then he should have had Pandey caught at the wicket by Alex Carey first ball. So, you know, yeah, he might have had a different day had Carey gloved it and taken two for it. But I was kind of thinking, mate, like, what if – I'm going to cop some pelters for this. What if Mitch Marsh batted eight? Would Mitch Marsh score more runs at eight and bowl better than Kutenile?
I don't think it's – I don't think that's – too bad a shout, really. I think Kutenile deserved to come in as Australia's best prospect at that point in the order. Once you get past Carey, the question then becomes who can come and bowl first change and is likely to score runs and is a decent fielder. I think Kutenile probably ticks those boxes. One thing that I've been surprised about with Kutenile is how benign his bowling looks, because in the past he's been able to very much carry opening the bowling for Australia and bowl at a kind of similar speed to Stark and Cummins, but he seems a way off. He almost seems like he's just bowling a change down. And also the fact that he's decided to grow his hair just makes him a little bit more of a tastier prospect for batsmen. If he just shaved his head. It's, you know, they had this discussion in the Premier League. When centre-backs have really good hair.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a Man United fan. I'm a bit sheepish about it. I don't apologise for it. I'm a bit sheepish about it. 1994 is not the team to go for. they had this conversation about Victor Lindelof, the Swedish defender. Beautiful, luscious head of hair.
Yeah.
But a lot of the fans from the north of England just say, just shave it, mate. Just show us what, you know, play like a central defender should. And I'm issuing that call to Nathan Kutenile. I'm a bald man myself, so I would do this. He has wonderful head of hair, but maybe just shave it down some.
just look a bit scarier. Intimidation
factor.
Well, and
Australia is all about symbolism and feel and
that's true.
Tangibilities. Just get run the number one through it and see how he goes feels about you. I think things might change.
Just another guy that in the all-rounder position, Marcus Stoinis, who is kind of going a bit under the radar, hasn't scored a run in anger in a long time. Bowling looks benign. It looks like he's getting targeted pretty comfortably by all batsmen. Is there anyone in the squad that Australia can replace him with? I think his position's fairly securely locked, but like he's batting at six, and it's a fairly important position. And got a duck yesterday or overnight. I can't remember the time he got to. I suppose he had a really good chance against the West Indies, then pulled a short ball straight to mid wicket. Australia need him. I mean, I keep saying this, but like, you know, if Australia win the World Cup, it's you guys like Stoinis who need to have amazing World Cups. I mean, Steve Smith's just peeled off another flawless 70. I feel like his runs are always going to be there. Stark had 5 wickets last game, didn't bowl particularly well yesterday, but it's your guys like Stoinis, it's your guys like Coulton Isle, Zampa. These are the guys who, if they have great World Cups, Australia might make it all the way to the final. I still feel confident that Australia will play a semi-final, which is realistically what if it was just about right. If Australia make the top four, you'd say they've had a pretty decent World Cup. But like, is there anyone, Pez, in this squad that Stoinis should be looking over his shoulder for?
I mean, there's no like-for-like replacement with Stoinis. It'd be more of a combination change. It'd be something along the lines of kind of shifting Carey up the order and ridding themselves of a batsman. Did note that Khawaja returned with, 40-odd overnight, so perhaps rumours of his short ball demise were a bit exaggerated, but and it might have been just a Windies thing and a wicket thing, but you might remove a batsman. Australia was slow yesterday. People thought there were one too many controlling bats. We might get rid of one of them, move Carey up, put a bit of impetus up the order and bring in Berendorf, Richardson or Lyon. But even so, that doesn't really solve the issue either. So I don't know. I mean, it seems pretty – unless they change the combination, he seems pretty safe, doesn't he?
Yeah, and it's funny because, as I was saying before, like in the next 3 games before England – Australia should win, and you can probably win by just having, two guys have like good days out. Cummins might take 4 and Smith might get 80, and you probably win the game for those next 3 games. But then you play against England, then you think, well, nothing, we haven't really learnt anything. So it'd be interesting to see if they change the squad at all. Dave Warner scored 56 off 84 balls. I noticed overnight, friend of the show, Jeff Lemon, tweeted he had 46 dot balls, which is remarkable for Dave Warner. His body language changed. Like, even just in the field, just doesn't seem to be. He's definitely not the ball anymore. He's not a gully. He's not revving up the bowlers by getting in the batsman's face and all that kind of stuff. He seems to be just a completely different personality. I mean, he had a wonderful IPL. He's got right back in the runs, but so far this World Cup has just he scored a couple of runs, but just looks. Looks like he's trying to spend time at the crease than he is like the old ravishing, front dog bull. A lot of animals going on there.
Yeah, that's right. I love the idea. Like Warner needs to be somebody. He needs to embody some kind of spirit. We don't know who he is otherwise. He must put this mask on for us to understand who he is. Maybe he's trying to warm into the cup, because the only thing that tempers me thinking that something is deeply wrong with him is what you said about the IPL. He was excellent in the IPL. He clearly has the gears that he can go through. Maybe he's trying to spend time at the crease. It is important, it's a long World Cup, mate. We'll probably forget this result in about 3 days. Or maybe that's just me and my early onset dementia, I don't know. But it's good that he's scoring runs. It is quite bizarre to have kind of absorbed that many balls. 46 dot balls and Australia lost by 36 runs.
Yeah,
I don't know. It occurs to me that a number of the opening pairs in the World Cup don't seem to be going all Jai Surya Kalawithrana either. That power play is there in the first 10 overs, most people seem to be consolidating wickets a little bit. I know England did that, through Bairstow and Roy in the first couple of games. They even did that in the last game against Bangladesh before they had enough of that quite quickly facing spinners. But, that might be part of the plan too. It might be a wickets in hand situation. I don't know. I know a lot of people overnight were calling for Maxwell to come in earlier, that he gave him, again, he had too much to do.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. What are the precise conditions that Glenn Maxwell needs, you know, to succeed? You know, like he was sort of in too early against the West Indies, in too late here. Does he need to sort of bat first and maybe have about 25 overs? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I still think Maxwell will win you probably two games in the World Cup, or, you know, or at least one. He's had 28 or 14 rocks overnight. So, yeah, I don't know. But I suppose you can get a bit carried away. But, yeah, as he came in, it's interesting they shifted the batting order. Khawaja was down at four and Smith came in earlier. So that was a strategic play about the run rate, covering for sort of a slower start. I'm not sure. But I like the idea of hiding a batsman at four. Oh, yeah, they're hiding him. They're hiding him at number four.
It's protective.
That's. I mean, Piers, let's satisfy all our Indian supporters over there. A market that we will definitely never crack. Of all the bowlers in this match, where there's, you know, about 400 or 700 runs scored in the match, two bowlers went for less than six and over: Pat Cummins and Jasprit Bumrah. Bumrah finished with 3 for 50, possibly the best seamer in this World Cup in a competitive field. How did you see India going overall? Some great performances. I haven't even spoken about Shikhar Dhawan's 100, Kohli 80, Bumrah 3 for 50. How do you see them? Do you see them as going all the way in this World Cup?
Yeah, they'd have to be the form team. I mean, that's the statement result of the World Cup. It's the first kind of blockbuster, and it felt like a bit of a procession for India. Like I said, they got out in front early. They weathered Stark and Cummins quite comfortably. I mean, I felt like neither opening batsman looked rushed facing Stark or Cummins, which is a testament to their skill, bit of a testament to the conditions. And then they didn't seem to be posed too many questions after that. They made their way to I mean, it's too easy to say when something looks easy, it's because the skill level is extremely high.
Yeah.
But they made their way to 350. They look to have a very balanced, flexible, you know, powerful but controlling batting lineup. Virat Kohli is at the centre of that, and he can play the Smith or Williamson role if he needs to, as he did overnight, and he can probably go at twice the rate if he needs to as well. Dhoni the same. So they just look... They look great. I mean, they are the, you know, them in England, I think we'd have to say now, are huge standouts to make the final. And it'd be a hell of a contest. Yeah. I'd love to watch India versus England.
Yeah.
And then, with the ball, you know, they have guys through the middle overs that can pose wicket questions. So through Kuldeep and Chahal. And Bumrah is the premier fast bowler on the planet, you know, in my view. So, you know. I'm not sure where the gaps are in India's side at the moment. Yeah. Australia certainly couldn't expose any, which I think is worrying from an Australian point of view.
Pez, it wouldn't be a show without speaking about Steve Smith getting booed by someone else now. But I don't know if you caught it, but it was when Kohli was batting and the Indian fans had been booing Steve Smith as he was fielding on the boundary. Great play by Finch to get Smith in amongst the fans. So I don't know if you caught this, but so Kohli started to walk towards some Indian fans who were booing Smith, and then basically told them to clap him, which was a really nice gesture to see. Kohli using his power for good. I know I've spoken about this. I'd probably harp on it about too much and then get you to have a take on it each and every episode. I just find booing in general just a really unusual thing to do, and I can't figure out, like, why people do it. Because, like, I was watching what game was it? It was a Bangladesh were playing. It wasn't an England game. Anyway. And there was like an appeal for LBW and it was given not out, and then people started to boo as if, like, how dare you appeal against the team that I support? and then when there's like a DRS review, happened a couple of times overnight, if there's like a caught behind, and then whilst like the captain, the bowler and the wicketkeeper all come together to think about if they're going to use DRS, like the crowd starts booing, just like, oh, I can't believe you would appeal. Why would you appeal against this? And then like somehow India are now booing Smith, and like it's weird. Smith's getting it worse than Warner. Like, where Smith wasn't even involved really. He was just, you know, captain of the Costa Concordia. So anyway, what's my question to Sam Perry about Steve Smith booing?
Well, I think we could talk about this every time and we will because we're just desperate for talking points. Clearly there's some social phenomenon going on. There's a, you know, copycat effect, bit of a mob mentality. What I'm talking about is, you know, Jesus and Barabbas
yes.
on the cross. You know, that's yes. calling for Barabbas. He was a murderer, wasn't he? Anyway. Not saying Smith is Jesus, although, you know, he did go down during Easter and he did bear the sins of Ian Chappell sledging onwards. But anyway, ungainly gay Jesus as well. But yeah, I don't know, mate. It's obviously quite funny for the crowd to do it now as well.
And we'll yeah, it's, so, it's like, it's this is my chance.
It's going to have a wave effect. Yeah,
yeah,
and
yeah.
And who knows? Maybe people will get bored of it. I'm not sure. It will pick yeah. back up at the Ashes, I presume.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, massively so.
Never relent.
That's right. Never relent and never repent. Let's talk about England and Bangladesh.
Yep.
Pez, Jason Roy hit the highest score of this World Cup so far. There's lots of stats about Australia conceded their highest ever score at a World Cup by conceding 350. I think those records mean absolutely nothing. Like the way batting has come along in the last last 4 years, like every record for every World Cup is going to get smashed. Also, like Australia might lose two games and they'll be like, that's the first time I've lost two games in a World Cup since 1993. Yeah, because we were fucking amazing for like 18 years in World Cups. So like all records mean nothing. Anyway, Jason Roy batted well. 150 against Bangladesh. Bangladesh put up a pretty decent fight as well, hit 280. Shakibul Hasan hit 121, who I think is the ICC number one all-rounder in the world. Obviously, fabulous finger spinner as well. So, England roll on, Pez, and Jason Roy back in some runs.
Yeah, I felt like it was the kind of, I know I say the word blueprint a lot, but it was a blueprint England victory. I know they like to chase, but they got sent in. They registered 386, you know, and then Jofra Archer was scary. Like,
yeah.
You know, it was England doing England things. They started slowly yeah. and, you know, then Jason Roy was 150 all of a sudden. Joss Butler hit 60 off two balls. you know, if someone doesn't get it, someone else will. And then, yeah. The victory was so comprehensive that Bangladesh didn't even chase it. They just tried to bat for net run rate, hitting 280 themselves. Make climb above stick. Australia in that final fourth spot as a result. So I'm not going to even try and explain net run rate. It's because I don't understand it, although I'll leave you thinking that I just couldn't be bothered explaining it. But, Jofra Archer with three for a terrifying spell. You know, he bowled a ball for six. A lot of people have seen that.
Yep. It's
clipped with bail. Pat Cummins told me a story once of, again, just dropping names, of him bowling the off-bail for six. So it actually hit the bail and the bail travelled for six. So beat that, Jofra.
Yeah.
I think it was under 12s and he was playing on a small ground, but
Well, some of these boundaries are like going to talk. Yeah. Pez, I found the thing with the Jofra Archer ball, that kind of, you almost like lose perspective of how quick these guys are bowling. And then you see a ball like clip a stump and then absolutely smash into the rope, which is what, probably 60 meters away. gives you a real perspective about how quick these guys are bowling. I think we said before, but like England were already favourites and then got Jofra Archer. Even that ball in itself just pitched off, hit off, just decked away. I noticed yesterday that the Australian bowlers, just put everything into an Australian perspective because we are kings, that like there was a lot of cross seam balls being bowled. I think Australia bowled with a new ball quite defensively. Mm. It's not like the over wicket had, you know, lots in it, but it's almost like
had nothing in it.
You know, like the bowlers didn't even try to get it to swing, and so it's hard to know if that was because the wicket wasn't doing anything, or they just legitimately just wanted to bowl back of length into the hip to not go.
I think
you
this
know.
The Kookaburra ball, white Kookaburra ball doesn't swing, and if there's nothing in the wicket, you're almost forced to bowl defensively.
Mm.
Yeah. I noted Cummins opened the bowling. Was there any discussion about that, just to go straight back to Australia-India?
Of course.
He bowled the first ball. I just wondered. I sometimes look at Pat Cummins and I see the breeze going through his hair, and not only do I feel excited about that on separate issues, separate levels, but he's always bowling into the wind, you know.
Mm.
I just wonder how it'd go without it. We need to keep things moving. He goes. Just quickly on New Zealand as well. Comfortable victory for them against Afghanistan. Kane Williamson, 70-odd not out. Jimmy Neesham, 5 for 31.
Mm.
Going to be a good match between Australia and New Zealand.
I think so, yeah. I think so. It's interesting because I noticed Trent Bolt, who can, you know, swing it in basically all conditions. Even he's been able to move it a little bit. But, yeah, you're probably right that the ball really doesn't swing anymore, which is interesting because, like, beginning of this World Cup, everyone thought it was going to be like 400 was going to be par. But, you know, there's only been a couple of scores so far in this entire World Cup of scores over 350. So it's interesting that the bowlers are very much in the mix, which is also fascinating that, you know, Australia did leave Josh Hazlewood at home, who 2 years ago was the number one ICC ODI bowler. Anyway, hard to say if I know anything at all that I'm talking about. We should probably explain why Dave isn't here. Dave will be joining the show later. I just thought about no swing and then I thought about Dave. So Dave is going to join the show, the back end of the cast. We'll be speaking to Adam Collins in a moment's time, then Niall O'Brien before we do hashtag AskTGC. Pez, before we go to the break, we should speak about the live shows that we're doing, the world tour that the Great Cricketer is on. Tickets available for Melbourne and Sydney before we head over to the UK, where we're doing Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, and two shows in London. Well, I think we spoke about it last week, but the first London show did sell out in a day. So the second London show is now available, which is the night before, which is Monday. It's a Monday night, which is 2 days before the Lords Test match. So do come along. It's Great Cricketer. .club. greatcricketer.club is where you can get all tickets to come and check us out on our live stage world tour. Just putting verbs and adjectives together. Pez, excited for the live shows?
Live shows are always great. They're loose. We have great guests.
They're good fun, aren't they?
We're doing a lot of work on a new act at the moment. It's a lot of fun. Last summer they were put it this way, we were going to record them as podcasts, and about 15 minutes into it, Ed Cowan just said, if you turn the recorder off, we can do this show properly, which we probably did. And we stopped recording them after that. I'm not trying to titillate people with X-rated material, but needless to say, it was suggested that it's Chatham House rules and nothing escaped the four walls. Everyone has phones, so that was a ridiculous idea, but... our guests and us are more likely to say things that we think, and as are the audience as well. So the live show is its own experience, and we do have some guests lined up that we're very, very excited to announce down the track, and the UK shows in particular are very exciting just because we expect to be booed as we walk on stage, because that's what it is.
That'd be really funny. Although now we've just encouraged people to do that. So that will cripple me, and I won't be able to perform. My performance anxiety, said every woman I've ever been with. Excellent advertisement for this podcast. Not so much for me. All right, Adam Collins coming up live from the UK, and then after that, Irish cricketing legend Niall O'Brien.
It's Queensgrove Sports' massive birthday sale. All brands reduced to clear. Kookaburra, Grey Nichols, New Balance, GM and more. Everything's priced to make you think it's actually worth it. Need a new stick to kid yourself that you'll actually average above 11 this season? Don't waste your money on actual therapy. Try retail therapy instead. We've got last year's stock with this year's stickers and double the price. We've got the brands of yesteryear too. Remember MRF? Brian Lara used one. So that must mean you're good enough to use it too. Flintoff and KP used a woodworm. I'm pretty sure they went into receivership, so we're basically giving them away. Remember when Albion sponsored Chris Martin, the worst batsman of all time? I have no idea how these bizarre alien pads didn't sell out. We've got them! What about those weird Indian brands that look like railway sleepers, weigh the same, and have absolutely no middle? We've got you covered. We even sell bats with no stickers on them, so it looks like you're trying to get sponsored. Even though you're in fifth grade. So rush into Queensgrove Sports today and make this season your last.
As Wikipedia says, the following guest, journalist guest, is best friend of the show. Can't deny it, to be honest. We're joined by Adam Collins again, an Australian voice after Australia lost quite comfortably to India. He was there. Collo, welcome.
G'day, choppers.
You presume
I
much.
I still say that. I mean, given that I'm like friends with your wife and I know your son quite well, can I still do that bit? I'm going to keep doing it.
Well, judging by the correspondence that we get, choppers and chop kings and stuff is still quite it's an object of fascination to many of our fans. Yes. So go for it. It's on brand. But you presume much.
All right.
Collo, you were there. How did you take it in? Can you first tell us about just the atmosphere in the crowd? We got a lot of people telling us that, you know, there was just there was a dab of gold in an ocean of blue. What was it like to be there?
Well, I found out during the game that 79% of the seats sold today were to Indian fans, but obviously you would have been able to tell on the television that there's lucky if there are 1,000 Australians there. So the working logic I'm basing this off is that Australians would have bought about a fifth of the tickets and realised they could sell them for a shitload of money on the resale market to Indian fans who are desperate to go, and they quite astutely flogged their tickets to Indian fans because Australia until a few months ago were pretty shit at one day cricket. So why would they want to go and watch India pump Australia on a Sunday when they could do almost anything other than that in one of the best cities on the planet? So that's my thesis anyway. It made for an amazing atmosphere. Where I was sitting in that outside bit, Sam, you know, in the press box at the Oval where you've got the fans sitting to your left. And I mean, it's a terrible cliche to talk about every Indian game being a home game, but it was like we were in India in terms of the noise they were generating. It was pretty cool, and it's hard not to get swept up in, really, at different points through the course of Australia's ill-fated chase, because the fans were just off chops, so outstanding.
Yeah.
Mm. Speaking of Australia's chase, Colo, we were kind of musing over Australia's slow start. They just seemed behind all game, really. But then in terms of the batting, they seemed to, and they've done this a few times now, curb a lot of that natural instinct that we've seen. Is this, was Warner's 56 off 84, do you think, part of some plan? Or is he out of touch? What is he? You know, we always need to put a moniker over David Warner. We need to describe him as the Reverend, the Bull. Now he's a slow coach. What's going on?
Yeah. Well, last week at Bristol, it was his slowest 50, and today he bettered that, so he's trending in the wrong direction. But at least he's setting records, so, you know, it's all about numbers. I think that to trial the intro of the piece I'm about to write, when Ben Stokes got in trouble at Bristol last year, he came back and tried so hard to be a team man and tried so hard to do his bit and to be seen to contribute as a disciplined member of the side that he became kind of useless with the bat. Not useless in the sense that he didn't make runs, but the role he was playing in the side changed. And he was no longer the guy who could score a century in a session or thereabouts, as, you know, what we became accustomed to in the first couple of years of Stokes' career, first few years, really. And I sort of fear the same thing's happening to Warner. He's so committed to doing the right thing and not being seen to be ill-disciplined at a time when he's returned back to the side after a fairly sort of punishing period of his life, that I'm theorising that maybe this has something to do with that he's trying so hard to do the right thing, but it's working against him, and he's not doing what, I mean, it's, again, for about the fourth cliche I've used so far since in 5 minutes, but he's not playing his natural game as a consequence. Because, I mean, and that's not to say the bowling wasn't top shelf today. Boogie and Jasprit Bumrah they could not have started the innings better. They were beating the bat, they were getting any movement that was left in that track, they were finding the seam and generating it. And they were creating ample pressure. But even in those situations, Warner has shown over a long period of time an ability to keep board ticking over in the first turnovers. Indeed, since the last World Cup 4 years ago, he's the only guy in the world who scores it better than a runner ball in the first 10 overs of a one-day international. So with that in mind, even though he's been out for a year, that's exactly what Australia needed from him today. Pretty much do exactly what you always do. And he did the exact opposite. At the end of the first power play, Australia was stuffed. I mean, I know that Finch had a big over in over 9 or over 10, but Warner and the general thrust of the innings was that they were well behind the eight ball. They needed to come out in the power play and leave a massive dent with their two most senior batsmen, Finch and Warner, and they weren't able to do so. And then after that, it got progressively worse until Maxwell came in belatedly, which I'm sure will come soon. And then by that stage, they were 12 and over or something ridiculous. So in the end, the scoreline flatters Australia. They deserve to get done by 60 or 70 runs, if not for Alex Carey making, you know, a very nice 50, but in junk time.
Colly, you're spending as much time around these guys as anyone, you know, outside of the team, really. And do you notice any sort of like personality change in particularly Smith and Warner, who the story of this World Cup is probably going to always be around? You know, for mine, like Steve Smith, his identity in the team wasn't as captain; it was just as the best player. And he's sort of come back, and his identity remains the same. Also, while just getting booed all the time. Whereas Warner's identity, as you've spoken about before, was really about getting the faces and being like this sort of me against the world mentality, where he's had to rein in just like after the Stokes incident, as he rightly said. So Do you notice a personality change?
Well, there's a bit to unpack from that, really, isn't there? I guess with Warner, the thing with him was that for the couple of years leading up to the Sandpaper farrago, he had already made that personality shift. I know it's a bit of a trope now to talk about the Reverend and the Bull and so forth, but I mean, he had fundamentally changed the way he was living his life.
Right.
And that was reflected in the way he was conducting himself on the cricket field. What happened in Cape Town was an aberration after a pretty significant shift in 2016 and 2017 and 2018, or the start of 2018. So I don't know whether it's necessarily that, but to be absolutely honest with you, I'm not spending tons of time around the team at the moment because the nature of this World Cup's for darting from city to city each day, and I've got broader commitments on this one. But from what I can gather, I mean, Pete Lawler wrote a really insightful piece about the dressing room the other day. It wasn't about Smith and Warner, but he made reference to Smith having taken up playing the guitar and singing on the team bus. Now, I mean, the Stephen Smith that we became accustomed to over the first, let's call it the first half of his international career before the Sandpaper ban, I don't expect he'd be the first person to get up and sing on the team bus and grab the guitar. Maybe there is some shifts in personality. It's hard to really measure. But, with Warner, I sort of would caution thinking that it's simply a case of he's got himself in huge trouble and he's now a different person. I think he was already a different person well before that, and then some pretty bad shit happened in South Africa, which melted into making some terrible decisions on the cricketing field, and we all know what happens next.
Mm-hmm. Colo, so now that we've watched enough World Cup matches, who wins the final between England and India?
Yeah, it will be a final between England and India. I still think England do. I mean, I still think England do because their bowling attack's so good. I mean, it's usually where we're talking about their powerful batting. But watching Jofra Archer bowl yesterday, it was the fastest spell an England bowler's ever bowled in the format. He's only getting better, and he's complimented in so many different ways around that attack. So yeah, they'll go around occasionally, but I think they're going to take 10 wickets most of the time. And then with the bat, again, they're just they're so deep. As we saw at the end of their innings yesterday, they've got so many guys who can pull it off at the end. And you see the sort of the contrast in Australia today. Once they were three or four wickets down, you couldn't really see Marcus Stoinis going out and playing that kind of innings. We all know he's got an amazing ability to clear the ropes and so forth, but it feels as though he needs things going in the right direction to pull it off. And he's a slow starter as well. That's the other thing with the England batsmen. Most of them aren't slow starters. Most of them can get moving straight away. So, I think you're right. They're the two favourites, and rightly so. And nothing's dissuading me from the idea that that they rightly will play off in the final in a month's time. If Australia make the semi-finals, I think it's a good result. I think we've got to manage expectations here. This is not a battle-hardened side who've been playing together as a group for 4 years, building to this like England or India. This is a team they've cobbled together pretty much in the last 6 months before the tournament. Pretty much in January they started getting this team together. They had no idea what they were doing in the 2.5 years before that. They've added Smith and Warner at the end of their suspension period, and they're hoping that can do it because they've got enough natural ability to get them over the line. But there's more to it than that. As we know in T20 tournaments, often a lot of it has to do with the way that teams gel and come together and work together and fit into different spots in the side. And I don't know whether that's necessarily happened with Australia. And I think today was evidence of that with the ball as well. After Stark and Cummins, it fell away pretty quickly.
Adam Collins, let's just give you one last little lap on Glenn Maxwell coming in late before we say goodbye. Yeah. 28 off 14. He looks likely. I know you're a huge fan of his. It increasingly seems that he requires quite a specific set of conditions to perhaps do his best. I mean, what kind of arrangement do they need to Justin Langer and the team need to create to give Glenn Maxwell the best opportunity to be the best version of Glenn Maxwell?
Yeah, I'd probably flip that around a bit and say that they had a great opportunity today to give Maxwell the chance to make a contribution at the time it mattered most. So when the second wicket fell, I think most people expected Maxwell to walk down the stairs of the bed stand, and it was Khawaja. After Smith was promoted ahead of Khawaja, I should add. So they already demoted Usman to four, and I think we just assumed that it must be Maxwell because they already needed, I think it was 8.5 and over at that point. So they made the decision to continue to consolidate, and the Indian spinners, they found it very hard to get the Indian spinners away. Khawaja, at the very tail end of their partnerships, hit a couple of boundaries, but they went, I think, 6.5 overs without hitting a four. So that gives you a bit of a feel for the way the game was drifting away from Australia. The run rate required when Maxwell walked out, I think, was 11.5. So, yes, Maxwell, 28 or 14, had to go from ball one, did go from ball one, did what he was expected to do. But I put it in the live coverage at the time. It was set up perfectly for Maxwell to be the scapegoat, because when you come in having to, you know, score at that kind of rate, you only have one option. Had he came in with 8 and over to make, that would have... It should have changed the way he went about it. He can tick over at 8 and over for a period of time and then go up a gear or two to do what we know he can in the final 10, but he never had that opportunity. So, yeah, I think today, what would have India least wanted at that point, if you ask yourself that question, they would have least wanted Glenn Maxwell to walk down the stairs. Instead, they got their best possible situation, Khawaja, who is, from the Australian top order perspective, the slowest scorer in between the two major power plays. So with that in mind, I'm not sure as much of it was Maxwell's fault as if they made. I think they just pulled the wrong rein and they brought him in at the wrong time to play that kind of role. Had he made 28 or 14 earlier, it might have just been the catalyst for a bit of momentum. Who knows? I mean, it's hard to argue the counterfactual point now, but yeah, I think it was a misstep.
Love it. A lot of missteps from Australia. Adam Collins, thanks as ever for giving us a perspective on the ground. We appreciate your insights.
No worries. I feel like every time we talk these days, it's so serious. Let's have a frolic at some stage soon.
Well, no doubt. Will do.
That is very good.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ. We champ.
The Great Cricketer is bringing their live show to the UK for the Ashes. Join Pez, Dave and Higos as they explore the A to Z of cricket. From club to country, from champ to chop king. With shows in Birmingham, Leeds, Manchester and London, The Great Cricketer Live promises to tackle cricket's deeper questions, like why do we inflict this game on ourselves? What does work hard really mean? Will a tight chest and enormous pipes push me up a grade? And why is my father's approval so pivotal to my happiness? With special guests in each city, the shows will provide the perfect tonic to England's impending World Cup win and Ashes triumph. Head to thegradecricketalive.co.uk for details.
A very special guest with us on The Grade Cricketer for this latest podcast, boys, Niall O'Brien. Let me read some stats to you. 101 ODIs, a test match, nearly 10,000 first-class runs, 15 first-class tons, 48 50s, nearly 500 dismissals at that level. Most importantly, I say that facetiously, as a great foundation in Sydney grade cricket as well, which we're hoping to mine deeply in Andrew Forrest style. He's now commentating with the BBC. He has a role with the ICC. This World Cup, so as an Irish international with a role at the ICC, I presume he can't say anything that he thinks, so we won't even ask him about that as well. So, Niall, welcome to the Grade Cricketer.
Morning, boys. Good morning. How are we all?
Very well, thanks,
fantastic,
mate. We always start the same way. What does grade cricket mean to you, Niall O'Brien?
Oh, listen, I've kind of spoken to you before about it. It was just a great time for me as a young lad when I first went over at 18. Just learning my trade, really. Just kind of learning from good experience, kind of pros and kind of good experience grade cricketers. Just learning the ropes the hard way, I suppose. It wasn't an easy thing to do as an 18-year-old, pack my bag and go to live in Sydney for 6-7 months a year. But yeah, I learned so much, made some great friends, and I think just playing great cricket, it's a tough experience, and it hardens you up, and it was certainly massive in my development, I think, as a cricketer, and it kind of fast tracked me forward. I think, you know, a couple of winters playing great cricket, I think, was equivalent to maybe potentially 4 or 5 years playing at home. So I think it kind of fast tracked my development, so I do owe a lot to it. I made some great friends along the way, probably more important, to be fair. Made good friends and lifelong friends and memories, which is probably more important, to be honest.
Can you? I just want to pick up on you saying it hardened you up. Can you just sort of elaborate a little bit on that, particularly with reference to the off-field, but let's say the on-field as well? I mean, how does cricket, especially Sydney grade cricket in the early 2000s, harden an individual up?
Well, you get nothing, like in grade cricket, you get nothing for nothing, really. You know, there's no there's no freebies on offer, whether it be when you're playing or training. You know, I kind of was surprised with the lack of kind of batting you might get, because, you know, I was coming from basically Irish cricket where you could play four or five games a week if you want, and all of a sudden you go to Sydney and yeah, you rock up and the nets aren't covered, so your grass and it rains on a Thursday. It used to rain all the time on Thursday for some reason. When there was practice and nets would be washed out, and you don't have a hit, and then you're fielding, and the next week you lose the toss, you're fielding again. So all of a sudden, it really makes you kind of cherish your time in the middle when you do get a chance to have a bat and value your wicket massively, as opposed to playing four or five days a week in Ireland or England. And if you get out, it doesn't really matter because you've got another game tomorrow. So that was a really massive thing for me, just kind of putting a high price on my wicket, and I kind of took that into my professional career afterwards. So that was a big thing for me. You know, there was obviously a lot of sledging as well. There was a lot of stick. Although I didn't get as much stick as the English overseas players, because once the Aussies found out that I was Irish, they're actually pretty friendly towards me. I got the initial Pommy this, Pommy that, and you know, I was pretty quick to say, actually, I'm Irish, mate. So they were all right, actually. You Aussies aren't too bad at all, to be honest. You're not a bad breed, despite what people might say.
It's kind of you to clear that up, Niall. We're relieved to hear it. You came over as a young, fresh 18-year-old Irishman. Can you kind of just talk us through the preceding years to grade cricket? I mean, you touched on a little bit about what cricket was like in Ireland, and, you know, playing a lot of cricket throughout the week. But, you know, was it rolling hills and, you know, Irish romanticist poetry? Like, what's cricket like in Ireland versus the aggression of the Sydney game?
Yeah, chalk and cheese, to be fair, chalk and cheese. You know, I grew up in a very nice part of Dublin, so, you know, our cricket was in the heartbeat of our community. So, you know, everyone was into cricket, very nice grounds and, you know, all that kind of thing. And very friendly, I'd say, quite friendly. But there was a bit of a shift in the kind of late 90s, right, early 2000s.
IRA?
And the, no, not the IRA.
Yeah. No, I thought that was where we were going.
When the Celtic Tigers came in, all of a sudden, lots of kind of Australians and South Africans and New Zealanders moved to Ireland for work and to earn a living. And all of a sudden, there was a big influx of cricketers.
Yeah.
So you think of a lot of people who went on to play for Ireland, like Trent Johnson, Alex Cusack from Australia, David Langford-Smith, obviously he's from a place called Orange in New South Wales. I'm led to believe that's famous for growing apples. I don't know how that works, but they're there.
Beautiful vineyards, yeah.
And there you have people, you know, South Africans like Andre Botha, who was a wonderful player. And all of a sudden, these guys started kind of manifesting into the club cricket in Ireland. And all of a sudden, there was a much more of a harder edge to Dublin cricket. But I suppose me and Sydney and Australia, I had a great affection for Australia way before I ever went to Australia, because I was a big fan of Steve Waugh and the Australian team, and you know, the early team of the 90s, really. They were my heroes. You know, Steve Waugh, Ian Healy behind the sticks. You know, Craig McDermott was my favourite bowler. I used to always try and copy his action when I was bowling in the nets, so just having a little mess around. You know, so these people were absolutely idols to me. So I had a great affection for Australia long before ever getting to Australia. So when I boarded that Qantas flight on the 5th of September 2000. It was a teary goodbye at Dublin Airport, it must be said, to mum and dad. I was 18, and as you say, fresh-faced, didn't really know a great deal about the big, bad world, but I couldn't wait to land and see. When I remember coming into Sydney and just seeing the Harbour Bridge and the Opera House, I made sure I had a window seat.
Did someone pick you up at the airport? Was some club president there to pick you up at the airport?
No. I didn't get picked up by the club president. I got picked up by a family friend of my mother's, actually, who I was staying with for 2 weeks. And then I had to find my own way, which was absolutely fine. I had a job lined up. Cookerer got me a job with Mick Pawley Sports out of Manly.
yes.
Sorry about that shameless plug there for Mick, but I don't even know if he's still going, Mick Pawley, but anyway. I had a job as an 18-year-old Irishman selling cricket gear to Australians, and it was very hard for these Australians to get their head around me telling them what bat they should buy, and no, that's too heavy for you, or you know, this grain isn't as good as this grain, you should go this, and they're like, mate, you're Irish. What do you know about cricket? And, you know, I didn't really have a response to be honest. I was like, yeah, fair call. But I said, I'll show you. Time will tell. And thankfully, a few years later, they probably looked and said, oh yeah, I remember that bloke told me about it.
Now, you're obviously from a very successful sporting background. Clearly, everyone listening to this podcast would know Kevin O'Brien as well, but also your sister Kira playing hockey for Ireland as well. It seems like a really common thing that like elite-level international sportsmen and women seem to have other, you know, siblings who are extremely successful. I think even like in recent times, like the Marshes, I think they've got a sister who plays netball as well, professional netball. Can you put your finger on why this seems to be like a common thread of like siblings like competing against each other type thing?
First of all, I'm one of six kids, so you obviously mentioned Kevin and Kira.
What happened to them?
excellent sports people, really, really top class, especially hockey. They're superb hockey players. But to be honest with you, they're a bit older than me. They didn't really have the infrastructure or facilities or access to coaches that, you know, was coming through when myself and Kevin and Kira were kind of getting into our sport. So they were probably left to their own devices a little bit more. Probably the system left to them. But they're actually superb sports players themselves. And my eldest brother actually plays hockey for Ireland over 40. So he's an international as well. Mm. And my old man, my dad was a cricketing and football legend. So I don't know if it's a theme, but certainly a very competitive family. We're all competing against each other, and we're all thrilled for each other when we succeed. But there is that a real competitive edge that I'd be lying if I said that if Kevin got runs and I got a duck, there wasn't a little hint of jealousy and thinking, oh, I wish that was me, because I think that's also human nature. I think I'm sure Kevin felt the same way. As much as we're thrilled for each other's success, We could always wish. Oh, I wish I did a bit better myself. So listen, I don't know if it's a team, but yeah, you're right. There is that around the world with the Marshes and people like that. But actually, I'm very impressed with that women, the female cricketer who just turned from Big Bash cricket to win the tennis.
Like, Ash Barty, yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to rack my brain thinking of other elite sports people who have changed codes, as it were, or changed games and just had success. So it's a bit off topic, but it was great to see.
That's all right. They're saying that she's the first Queensland cricketer to win the French Open. Niall, I just want to paint a bit of a picture for our listeners, and you know that I've kind of banged on about this to you in private beforehand, but you were part of a first grade side at a club called Bossman in Sydney, who at one period in the early 2000s boasted an opening bowling partnership of Brett Lee and Shoaib Akhtar. In that side
was
Andrew Strauss, Shane Lee, and myself. So just a double-pronged question. How was that to keep to from a cricketing perspective? Don't spend that much time on it. Tell us about the circuit afterwards as well with Brett Lee and Shoaib Akhtar, please. Thanks.
Well, listen, I think my two memories of Shoaib Akhtar playing for Mossman wasn't about cricket, really. It was about turning up for a 50-over game on a Sunday with a woman on each arm and a bucket of KFC. That was my abiding memory of the great Shoaib Akhtar. That is truth. I can picture him walking into Alabama Oval now, late for warm-ups, with a woman on each arm and a bucket of KFC. I thought, wow. This lad's getting about 20 grand a game. And this is how he is. And then he went out and Richard Cheekwe, the top-class Randall Peterson batsman, smashed them all over the place. Got 120, I could be mistaken, but I think it was 121 as Randall Peterson chased down a score against Mossman. But there was a big crowd there, and I saw Brett Lee last week. I had a couple of Brett Lee in London. It was good to see him, but he was always amazing. Brett, such a kind of professional. And then I saw this other bloke going, both ends of the spectrum, I suppose.
Can we talk about your? I mean, we just touched on Mossman. You also played at North Sydney, where Sam and myself played.
I did. That was great fun.
I happen to know that our former club president once paid one young coach in the way of government bonds. to be fair, you know, bonds are a very low-risk investment, so probably a good deal, but a bit weird. Anyway, how were you approached by North Sydney, and what were the terms of your deal?
Well, to be fair, I was meant to go back to... I'd flown myself to Sydney, and I was meant to go back to Mossman again. And then I got to Sydney, and then all of a sudden I got the old call from Mossman, said, "Oh, sorry, Irish, we've actually registered 3 overseas already." So I said, "Oh, that's nice. Cheers, lads." So I've had to fly myself over, and you haven't got a place for me in your club. Obviously, you can only have 3 overseas. So I was having a few beers with Kieran Sharp, the original Irish, and also a great man. And he said, "Listen, I'll have a word with North Sydney." So I went, basically had a training session with Gordon, and I thought, don't like this place. I'm not keen on the Stags. And then I had a coffee with a certain Devin White. It was like a match made in heaven, me and Dean White. I must say, absolutely fabulous. Although I was told to make sure I just double checked all my $50 notes every Saturday that there wasn't a couple that were larger or smaller than they should be. So that was but to be fair, whatever I was getting, and I wasn't getting much, it didn't get far past Saturday night in Percy's, to be fair. I normally went straight back into the club in one way or another.
I'm just glad that our global audience that spans at least 12 to 13 countries has experienced 15 minutes of like a North Shore cricket conversation. Let's make it a little bit more global, Niall. You're obviously at the World Cup. You're in World Cup folklore for hitting a match-winning 72 from 107 balls against Pakistan. So we've just fast-forwarded from you playing second grade at Mossman to hitting 72 against Mohammed Sami in the 2007 World Cup. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you tell us about your memories of that game? That was a huge boil over to have knocked over Pakistan then as well. So once again, the question is, tell us a little bit about the on-field and then the off-field.
Yeah, I suppose on field, I was playing the worst I've ever played in my life leading into the game. So I don't actually know how I managed to get any runs, let alone 72. I was in no form to the extent that the day before the game, I didn't even have a bat. I said to coach, no point having a bat. I'm batting that bad. And my character was, I'd get very upset myself if I was batting badly, and I'd make it even worse. So I'd get more and more angry, more and more cranky, more narky. So I just said to coach, "I'm not batting today, mate." Just the day before the game, I did my keeping practice, and I went back to the hotel. And for some reason, we were off for rain after bowling about 134, maybe something like that. And we were off for rain at the interval, and I went into this car park and had some throwdowns. So, picture: I'm in a car park surrounded by a big team bus, pebbles everywhere, rocks everywhere. I'm just having little throwdowns, and all these Pakistan fans are looking at me going, "What? Who's this joker? He's an absolute clown, this fella. What's
throwdowns in the car park?
How's he going to get him?" And then I got a long hop early on, I think, and I cut it away to the boundary off Sami. And then the adrenaline just kicked in, and just something clicked. And it's probably one of the best things I've ever played from a technical point of view and mental. You know, everything just kind of fell into gear, and it was happy days until I had a bit of a brain fart, really, and ran down the wicket. I parked a man for 6, and then I said, "I'll do it again." Next thing, I was stumped, face down in the mud, dragging myself off some minor park, thinking, "What the hell have I done, you absolute idiot?" But then I said, "Oh, we don't need 20 to win. The lads can't cock this, surely." And before I had 2 pads off, we'd lost 2 more wickets. Carl McCallum and Andrew White went in 2 buffs, successive buffs, and I was like, "Oh, Jesus, what have I done here? We can't cock this up, surely." And, thankfully, Kevin played one of his more mature innings. He was getting 16 or 51 balls. 4 years later, he got 100 off the same amount of balls. And Trent Johnson, a good bear, hit one into the stands, snowball, I don't know. And we were instantly kind of famous, I suppose. And we were on absolute riding the wave. And then off field, very difficult to remember. We had 2 days on the absolute lash, so we drunk for free in Jamaica for 2 days, and that is not a word of a lie. The hotel said, "All your drinks are free. Here's a wristband. Crack on." And the Irish did it well, to the extent that the hotel had to go to another hotel down the road after a day and a bit to get more alcohol because we drunk and dry.
Very good. It was the you just touched on the 100 that Kevin got against England in the next World Cup. Is that probably? I mean, obviously the history between Ireland and England and everything around that, that's got to have been, if not the highlight, certainly one of the best highlights of your career.
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, to beat England in the World Cup was absolutely sensational. To chase 320-odd and doing it, even better. Doing it in India in front of a full house at Bangalore, incredible. I think, you know, beating Pakistan set Irish cricket up and put us on the kind of path to where they got to with the Test match last year. But that England win just kind of catapulted it again. Really gave everyone a kind of fresh injection of love for the game, and probably put it more mainstream and more widely accepted that cricket in Ireland was a thing to be reckoned with. So I think that was our kind of best day out. Certainly. In terms of kind of magnitude, beating England is something that Irish people absolutely love to do in any sport, whether it's rugby, tiddlywinks, whatever. Beating England is something we love to do. But in saying that, I think our chase against the West Indies and Nelson in 2015 was probably our best batting performance, because it was a unit. You know, everyone kind of chipped in. Sterling got 90, Jones got runs, I got a few. You know, everyone kind of got runs on. Yeah, it was, again, another chase of 300-plus, which Ireland have chased 300-plus three times the World Cup. So, you know, obviously different games, but I think the England game stands out as, you know, probably the biggest in our history.
Niall, just finally, before we go, we do get a lot of people writing to us and lobbying us to talk more about Associate Nation cricket. But can you just tell us, where's Irish cricket at the moment? You obviously played a test against Pakistan yourself in 2018, last year. There's test status now. You know, where's Irish cricket at? What can people look forward to when it comes to Ireland cricket?
Sure. Well, it's a tough time. I'm not going to lie to you. The results have been difficult. T20 cricket at the moment, Ireland, the Irish team is struggling massively. But on the flip side, there's good young talent coming through. And I think finally, the selectors and the coaches have realised that they've got to bring some young players in. Too long, there was just too many people, the same team, same for all different formats. You know, it was getting a bit stale. And the public were getting a bit disjointed, really, with the side, and you know, the results not being as they should. So finally some young lads coming through. I would like to see more young lads playing personally. There's some good players coming through that haven't got the opportunity yet. They're playing Zimbabwe soon, so hopefully that's going to be a good opportunity to get more young lads in. Take someone like Josh Little, a left arm seamer, made his debut against England, got 440, you know, bounced out Owen Morgan, had the whole ground and crowd on their feet, you know, enjoying their cricket again. So that's what young people can do. And that's the future of the game. So as difficult as it might seem at the moment, results-wise, and it is difficult, there is a good crop of young players coming through. And I think when I say young, I'm talking kind of 18 to 21, 22. I'm not talking 15-year-olds. So these guys are, you know, they're playing first-class cricket, so they're coming through, they're nearly ready to go. And so I'm hoping the next couple of years are going to be fruitful. There's a big tournament happening in August and September. Ireland have their own T20 competition, which is set up called the Euro Slab. And they've got Owen Morgan, Brendan McCullum, Luke Ronke, Shahid Afridi, Babar Azam, some high-end international players and marquee players playing in the tournament. So that's going to be good for Irish cricket. There's going to be 18 players contracted, 80 Irish players contracted. They're going to get better at T20 cricket. And then there's a World Cup qualifying tournament in Dubai, October, that Ireland just have to qualify from to get to the World Cup in Australia. So it's a big, big 6 months. Not forgetting Test match against England in July. But all in all, you know, the future is bright. It's tough. The results have been tough, but I believe that things are on the right course, and I'm looking forward to these young lads coming through, showing their worth in the near future.
Oh, a thorough answer to finish off, Niall. Thanks so much for giving us a trip from Dublin to Mossman to the World Cup in Jamaica and finishing with
Thank you,
the upside of Irish cricket.
Very nice welcome. Chatting as always, I appreciate it. Appreciate it. Thanks, Lewis.
Lads, Budgie Smuggler, our very best friends. It's important to rank your friends like MySpace back in 2007. And Budgie Smuggler are our very best friends. And we need to talk about them so people all across the land is wearing Budgie Smugglers.
They are best friends like when you interact with someone the most on social media, their content goes to the top of your news feed automatically. Level I friends?
I think so. I want to see more people. Like, I was watching State of Origin during the week, lads, in between watching Afghanistan play cricket. And just great advertisement for rugby, you know, Budgie Smugglers, rugby league players wearing shorts. I want to see cricket players drop their dacks more on the field, get exposure. I'm talking brand exposure more than, you know, on this cricket podcast that we speak about. Can we think of some ways that, like, you know, cricket players can get Nathan Lyon's face out there on your junk, like we spoke about last week?
It's hard to think about that on field necessarily, and obviously it's a social faux pas to wear Budgie Smugglers of any kind in the shower, but perhaps we're just because of fiscal pressure, we're going to now start a revolution for people to shower in their Budgies, or we lose all credibility.
Could Budgie Smuggler, and I'm just talking to the founder of Budgie Smuggler right now, could they maybe invent a pair of smugglers that like glow in the dark or something, like, so during an ODI, like a day night one day match, kind of activate under your whites so you can see Nathan Lyon's face come up, you know, during the second half of a day night match. I'd like that.
I like that as an idea, certainly, Eddos. You remember how, like, back in the old days when Bales just used to be Bales, but then they made them Zing Bales. And now, now I've never wanted to see a batsman get bowled, you know, more than ever, you know, just for that infinitesimal moment where the, you know, a light is activated on some wooden stumps.
So you're calling for some internet enabled Budgies, just like the Bales are internet enabled?
I am calling for radical change.
Okay. You've always done that.
I think, I mean, anything that is looking to succeed in the digital revolution needs to be connected to the Internet of Things.
Internet of Things,
and
IoT.
Budgie Smugglers are no different, even if you're driving into water.
Even if you're driving into water. That's BudgieSmuggler.com. Best friends of the show. Lads, hashtag AskTGC. The people want to know the answers to the questions that they've been thinking about for weeks and weeks and weeks on end. This one comes in from Dougal Graham. Dear hashtag AskTGC, it's a polite way to start. Appreciate that, Mr. Graham. I'm a relative newcomer to the podcast, but a big fan already. It's interesting hearing your predictions and opinions from early episodes 2 years after the fact. Listening to the podcast has inevitably led me to consider my own cricketing career, an activity that I have chosen to avoid up until now, as it mostly composed of failure and disappointment. School lunch and tea spreads were rare exceptions. One memory struck me as particularly interesting. In under-12s, my club team was made up of a combination of the two teams that had won the previous year's under-11s competitions. Incidentally, Dave's brother Rob was in the team. Most teams at the club were named after a famous contemporary cricketer, e.g. Slater or Waugh. The coaches of my team, one being my dad, decided to call us Bradmen. At that time, I thought nothing of it. Now looking back on it, I'm struck at the sheer audacity of naming your son's under-12s cricket team after the greatest cricketer ever. What was he thinking? I'd love to hear your thoughts on the matter. P.S. I've never actually asked him about this, but why change that now when I can ask you guys? P.P.S. I realise this isn't about great cricket per se, but I feel the sentiments remain the same. What was he thinking? What was his dad thinking?
I always wondered, like, about... So I played for Linfield, as he said. You know, my brother played in that Bradman team. I always wondered about naming rights for those Linfield teams. Like, did they ever consult the players? Like, I obviously know that, you know, Bradman was quite savvy commercially. I reckon the clubs would be paying 20% of all player subs to Bradman's estate if he even knew half of it. I was in Linfield.
You
McGrath.
Always thought about that as a 10-year-old and 11-year-old.
Oh, I'm always wondering about rev share splits. Pez, at all times and all costs. I was in Linfield McGrath initially, then I played for Whitney, and I think even Linfield Matthews and at one point, and even Linfield Slater as well. I remember Slater came down for a guest appearance at Try On Over once and signed a copy of Slats Opens Up for me. Just, dear Dave, play straight, fuck off.
Well, we've finally done it. We finally ended the show. Thanks as ever for dividing our group, and this is the last ever podcast we'll ever do. Signing off for the Great Cricket Podcast. We'll see you next time.